On March 16, 2000, two sheriff's deputies were shot in Atlanta. Jameel Al-Amin, a Muslim leader and former Black Power activist, was convicted. But the evidence was shaky, and the whole truth didn't come out during the trial. My name is Mosi Secret, and when I started investigating this case in my hometown, I uncovered a dark truth about America. From Tenderfoot TV, Campside Media, and iHeart Podcasts, Radical is available now. Listen to the new podcast, Radical, for free on the iHeart Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Marissa Alexander is one of the most amazing people I've ever met. In 2012, she was a supervisor at work, a 31-year-old mother for the third time, and a licensed gun owner. She was in an abusive marriage, and shortly after giving birth, her husband beat her up yet again, and when she tried to leave, he blocked her only exit. She got her gun and fired a warning shot. He left, and then he called the police, which launched an odyssey for Marissa that led to her getting a 20-year prison sentence while her newborn was at home with someone else. Nightmare. How did she deal? How did she make it through? Because she's home now. She's still going through a lot, but she's home. Marissa Alexander's incredible story of success through a nightmare. Today on Torre Show.
How are you?
I'm well. I'm really well, actually.
Yeah.
I'm good.
I mean, you know, we say to each other, how are you? Mm-hmm. And it's a throwaway question.
Right.
But
right.
I mean, as someone who spent a lot of time talking about you mm-hmm. and thinking about you without actually knowing you.
Right.
And seeing you've gone through this, you know, massive ordeal.
Right.
How are you? Like, in life at right. this moment?
Right. That's a good question, because I think when people ask me that, they're like, really, like, how are you, like, the trauma that they got to see, and like, oh, if I was in her position, how would I feel? And I am really, really well. It's really uplifting to be in this position, to be able to be on the other side, right? And such a fortunate position to have my freedom back, right? And then be able to move forward with a message, do it with a smile, right? And then be able to take care of myself in doing that, because it's the human cost work, right? But at the same time, I'm fortunate, you know. I am here sitting in a hotel instead of a prison, right? I'm really doing well. And I have the best opportunity, which is to give back.
You lived through a nightmare.
Yeah.
How did you survive this nightmare? Just like, what in you personally allowed you to survive this nightmare and come out the other end with a smile?
Well, you know, the truth is I have a deep-rooted faith. And that's just something that my mom raised us to really understand. So she was, you know, bringing us to church like every Sunday, some Wednesdays, that kind of mom. So you have the foundation. And then she was the example. She set the example. She's strong. So for me to be strong, I come from strength. That's number one. And then the other thing is just to be able to really put things into context in terms of really saying, wait a minute, something, this is bigger than me. I don't know what's going on, but my faith is that this won't end like it feels right now. You know what I'm saying? So I really believe that this calling and this thing that was happening to me was bigger than me. And so there was a transformation that it needed to take place within me in order for me to be able to come through that. And then understanding, truth be told, I just really had to become a different person in terms of the Marissa that was, you know, the mother, the manager, the person that was educated, and all those things, to become somebody who needed to survive the environment that I was in order to be able to come out.
When you talk about your faith mm-hmm. Sustaining you, mm-hmm. is there a particular story from the Bible or story from Christianity or yeah. lesson from Christ that you're like, this I can cling to?
It was David. It was just David. It was Psalms, because understanding, you know, my mom is somebody who's always talked about David. And I'll be honest with you, I was like, okay, I know who David was, but I didn't know the story of David. And so honestly, you know, being that I, you know, read it, understood it, heard it in church, but I started with that. And then to me, he was him being a man after God's own heart. And he was completely fallible, right? But he was still a man after God's heart. So just to be his ability to be vulnerable. He cried, he prayed, he praised, he did, you know, he made major mistakes. And so I could identify with that. And he was still able to walk into his calling when he was anointed as king. And so to me, that is what always resonated with me was David, because he had a sense of purpose and strength when he first killed Goliath and didn't even realize where he would be. But he was still able to be completely human, vulnerable, but be exceptional as well.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So let's, I want to tell a story of what happened to you, but I want to start by setting the scene. So before this, the fateful day that starts this in motion.
Right.
Before that, what was your life like? You were pregnant, right? You were in a difficult marriage, right? Getting out of it, like, but pursuing a master's, working. So tell me just in general, what was your life like?
Well, prior to getting in that relationship, you know, I had already completed my master's, right?
In what?
And master's in business, in business administration. And so by this time, I'm like, probably about a good 8 years into the company that I had already been working with. At that point, I was a manager, so I had a team of 14 direct reports.
What were you doing?
I was an IT service manager for a payroll company. So my team pretty much handled the time and attendance piece that fed into payroll. So it's a 24/7, 60, you know, 365 type of job. Okay. And so, and as a manager, I was the point of contact. So I was doing that, finished up my master's degree. My kids were doing great. They were in school.
How many did you have then?
I had two. They were twins. They're both the same age. So my daughter's in gymnastics. My son's playing football. You know, I'm getting off of work and I'm taking them. You know, just your normal average day life. And so, and then, you know, things just shifted.
Well, so when you had your third child, right?
Right. That wasn't until 2000. So if we're talking about 2008 to 10, that was about 2 years from that point.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So describe what happened on the day in question.
Well, it was just one of those things where, you know, obviously there was a misunderstanding and an intent from my ex-husband. And it was a situation where I was already intending on leaving, which if you're not aware, the most vulnerable time for a survivor to try to leave is, you know, that's a vulnerable time for them when they're trying to get out. So here I am planning this leave. My baby is in the hospital. I'm trying to get back to her. And in his intentional, you know, rage, I was attacked. And even when I tried to separate myself and distance myself, which is what I thought would create a barrier and maybe he would leave, that did not work. And so ultimately I had a choice to make.
You had no choice to make.
I had a choice to make.
Which was what?
Which was to make sure that I defend myself in a way that I was not the casualty, but I was grateful enough that nobody was, but I was able to defend myself. I was not able to leave my home.
Okay.
Okay, which is what I wanted to do.
That's what I meant.
Right.
You were able to leave the room.
I was able to leave the room, but was not able to get out of my garage.
He was preventing you from leaving the house.
He was, at one point he was, and then once I went to the garage to leave, I was not able to once I came back in because I had no other way of getting out of the home.
Correct.
As you recall, the garage was not operational.
Right.
So when I went back into the home, I needed to make sure that I was able to protect myself because I had already endured the attack prior to me going to my garage and was not able to leave.
So he had beaten you up that day.
Mm-hmm.
And you were like, no more.
Right.
And I have to get out of this house.
And I have to get to my baby in the hospital. I have to survive.
So you fired into the ceiling.
Yeah, that's the report. But essentially what it is I scared off my abuser. And if anybody knows anything about shooting guns without getting too technical or weapons, is that when I fired it, actually went up. The trajectory went up and then it went into the ceiling. So it was in a direction, but not at him.
You were not intending or wanting to shoot him. You wanted to scare him.
Exactly. Exactly.
Was this your gun?
Oh yeah, it was mine. It was registered in my name. I had a concealed weapons permit, so yes, yes, it was.
How long had you had a permit?
I can't remember when I actually got the permit. But I can tell you this: I had been around firearms for years because my father's retired military.
Okay.
You know, so this is something that is not for, it is not foreign to me. He also trained us. You know, I was
your father.
He has my father. He has three girls. He took us to the range. We understood the responsibility of and the privilege of actually being able to carry a firearm. And so what we all did, which is all of my siblings, we obtained our concealed weapons permit. So I can't remember when I actually did it. Might have been about 2007 or 8 or so. But I didn't, you know, once I got it, you know, it was just to make sure that I was within the right framework or the law, especially when I was carrying it around with me in my vehicle.
But yeah, there's a lifelong understanding
right.
of firearms.
Respect.
How to use them.
Right, absolutely.
So full knowledge.
Right.
Okay. So you fire a warning shot
right.
away from him,
mm-hmm.
right, to
mm-hmm.
say, leave me alone, I'm serious.
All right, back off.
Yeah. Had you used a gun mm-hmm. to scare him off before?
Oh, no. I had never fired my firearm in the context of some type of conflict or anything like that. And I was always under the understanding and belief that once you do pull it out, you need to be ready to use it.
Yeah.
So it was not something that I carried in a casual manner, mentioned it any kind of casual way, because I don't believe that's something that you play with. But that was the first time ever.
So are we correct in reading that she pulled out her gun this time? That's mm-hmm. like my level of I'm done with this, I'm done with you, I'm done being hit by you mm-hmm. is just over the top.
It's more or less like, at this point right here, I am so in fear that this could be the inevitable day that is not a risk I'm willing to take. So this is the measure that I have to make sure that it does not happen. Because there had been other incidents, right? There were other incidents of violence. But this particular day, even with the opportunity for him to leave, even with the opportunity for the separation to take place and the state that I had never seen him in before, I knew that this was going to have to be the day, because I needed to be able to make sure that I survive and I get to my baby in the hospital.
You were in fear for your life in this moment.
Oh, yeah.
And how old was your baby?
She was 8 days old.
So, I mean, that's a lot just going through you there
right.
I have to get back to her and just...
Well, I mean, as a woman, right, you give birth, you know, I'm in the hospital 2 days, right? So then that gives me roughly maybe 6 days, and most women are still having the women thing after that. I'm pumping milk, so I'm doing this every 3 hours regardless of if she's there, because that's the supply and demand.
Yep.
I'm tired because I'm doing it every 3 hours.
Yep.
I'm going to a hospital that's 45 minutes from my house, staying there to go feed her, hold her so she can connect with me and have a bond,
right.
And then spend a couple of hours at the hospital in the parking lot, go back up and do a feeding, go home and change, shower, just to be able to go back and do it the next day. So this is a lot of exhaustion, right? There's a lot of, I'm not getting that much sleep. I'm having anxiety that I'm dealing with. These are different things that all took place this particular day, in addition to having to defend my life.
So you fire the weapon,
mm-hmm.
and then what happens?
It worked. Yeah, I was able to preserve my life and ward off an attack.
He left.
He left.
Because you
yes.
fired, he left.
Yes.
But he called the police?
Yes.
So then what happened?
Well, then at that point, I was receiving phone calls from the police, and I didn't know that it was who it was. Because I was thinking, oh, my God, like, is that him? Because initially I sat down because I didn't have my phone. So I'm sitting there like, oh, my God, it just happened, right? So at some point, my phone is vibrating, and I'm like, well, I don't know this number, right? And I call my sister, and I'm like, where are you? And then she tells me, like, please don't come outside because there's, like, cops everywhere.
How did she know that?
Because she was coming to help me to leave that day. This was my escape. This was me getting out. So she was coming to help me get the rest of my stuff, which I had been getting out of the house slowly. And so her intent was to meet me over there that day.
So she's outside,
mm-hmm.
and you call her, and she's like,
mm-hmm.
it's
right.
everybody out here.
Right.
So, I mean, you had to surrender at that point, correct?
You know, it wasn't an issue of not surrendering, because I was never... I wasn't being in an environment where they were trying to contact me, and I was like, no, you
right,
know, it
right.
wasn't like that. I just didn't know that they were out there. You know, I wasn't going to answer that call because essentially I thought it was him.
Right.
Right. And to be honest with you, I didn't call the police because I didn't believe I did anything wrong.
Right.
Seriously.
Right.
So at that point, I was like, okay, when I finally connected with the officer and I let him know, you know, that I was not okay, and then I would come out, that's when I came out.
When I was growing up, it meant so much to hear Black voices like James Baldwin and Toni Morrison talk about the Black experience, because Black stories matter. The next generation of influential Black voices can be found on NPR's new collection, Black Stories, Black Truths. Black Stories, Black Truths is a celebration of Blackness from NPR. Each of NPR's Black voices are as distinct, varied, and nuanced as the Black experience itself. In the Black Stories, Black Truths collection, you'll hear stories of joy, resilience, empowerment, and creating world-shifting things out of struggle. Every episode is a living account about what it means to be Black today. From The Wire to Bobby Shmurda, from Michelle Obama to reparations, there's no limit to the range on Black Stories, Black Truths. Black perspectives have not usually been centered in the telling of American stories. Now, they are the story. In NPR's Black Stories, Black Truths, you'll find a collection of some of NPR's best podcast episodes celebrating the Black experience. Turn on NPR today and hear real Black stories, because stories should never be told about us without us being in them. Listen now to Black Stories, Black Truths from NPR, wherever you get your podcasts. Life doesn't happen in bi-weekly segments, so why should your paycheck? The money you earn every day can be in your hands today with Earn In. Earn In is an app that gives you access to your pay as you work, up to $100 a day or up to $750 per pay period. Just download the Earn In app, verify your paycheck, and then you can access up to $100 a day as you work and leave an optional tip. Any money you access plus tips automatically repaid from your next paycheck. So if you need to make a repair suddenly, to get a new dress or a new shirt or shoes, you can do that. You can get the money that you've already earned but haven't been paid. You can get that now with Earn In. Make Earn In a part of your financial routine and join their 3.5 million customers who say things like, when I think about Earn In, I think about financial stability and security. It gives me peace of mind. It gives you the ability to access your money now. So download Earn In today. That's E-A-R-N-I-N in the Google Play or Apple App Store. When you download the Earn In app, type Torre Show under podcast when you sign up, and it'll really help us. Torre Show under podcast. Earn In is a financial technology company, not a bank. Subject to your available earnings, daily max, pay period max, and location. See earnin.com/TOS for details.
Influencer. It's a word that gets tossed around a lot these days. There is a woman who went the distance, who broke ground as the first true influencer by living a remarkable life. Her name, Elizabeth Taylor. I'm Katy Perry. This is the story of the original influencer. This is Elizabeth the First. Elizabeth the First, the podcast, wherever you listen.
We'll get back to the show in 1 second, but let's talk about a sponsor who's really been sticking with me week after week. Really appreciated Saks Underwear. And you know, Father's Day is coming up, and I think you should look out for Dad with some underwear that he really will want to wear and will feel super comfortable in. I'm talking about Saks, right? It's not the normal underwear. It just feels good. It makes you feel comfortable all day. They've got this ballpark pouch that takes care of you. Everything stays put, no friction, no chafing. They look great. They feel great. I put it on in the morning and it just fits, and it just fits right. It feels good, and I don't have to think about it for the rest of the day. And that's something you don't really want to have to stop in the middle of the day and think about. Last week, I told you they were official underwear of Wakanda. The guys at Saks called me and told me that is not true. They are not the official underwear of Wakanda, but they are good enough to be the official underwear of Wakanda, which is probably what I meant. But look, think about getting Saks underwear for dad for Father's Day. You go to the site, saxunderwear.com, saxxunderwear.com. Use the promo code Toure at checkout. Get $5 off because of Toure. And you get free shipping on your first purchase. So go to saxunderwear.com, saxxunderwear.com. Use the promo code Toure at checkout. Get $5 off some great underwear that they probably would wear in Wakanda if it was real. So, okay, so you were arrested. Mm-hmm. What happened from there?
Well, that's a very numbing process at that point, because honestly, I had never been arrested. Don't even know anybody that has. So I was kind of like, so, okay, I'm getting ready to go down to the precinct. It's going to be like Matlock or something. You see on Law and Order. And they're going to just hear me out because it's the truth. And, you know, then I'm going to be okay. And it was far from it. Far from it.
Well, at what point did you start to go, oh, this is not Matlock and the truth is not going to set me free?
When they were like, so your breast pump bag is going over there and you go in this room and line up in handcuffs, by the way, and you go and change and put on this uniform. And I'm like, for what? You know, and that's when I was like, oh, Lord. I'm asking the officers as I go through intake, like, what's going to happen now? I had no idea.
So they put you in a lineup.
Yeah, you come in the intake. It's a process, and you go through the little line, and you do your little health check, and you sit there and get your little number. All these little things that happen in intake that I had no idea what was going on, what was going to happen next, and because it was so late in the evening, my arraignment wasn't until the next day in the morning, so I had to stay overnight. My breasts are engorged because I'm pumping milk.
Sure,
and I couldn't make a phone call to anybody. Never. I had to ask somebody how to do it. You know, I didn't know what was going on.
So, but you did get out that time.
I got out the next day.
You got out the next day. Mm-hmm. Now, it was several months before the trial began, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And one of the things that was confusing to a lot of people who were watching the trial from afar, mm-hmm. Was that you went back to see your ex-husband, mm-hmm. right, in that in-between period, right. right? And a lot of people were like, well, if she's so afraid of him, why did she do that? So what happened in that situation?
Right. So here's the thing. There's obviously a misunderstanding. So he put a restraining order out on me the first incident. Okay, but then there's a felony, okay, no contact as well. Now, I had already obtained an attorney, and so understood that. 30 days after the incident, he removed the restraining order with the intent to be able to see, you know, our daughter. In addition to that, this is not something that was not known to my attorney at that time, because he was the one who let me know about it. Okay, he was trying to communicate with me. I contact my attorney and say, hey, he's trying to reach out to me. He's like, okay, you know, you can't talk to him. And so the next day, he's like, he removed the restraining order. So what do I do now? I'm asking my legal representation, what do I do? Well, what does he want to do? Well, he wants to talk to you and he wants to make this right because he knew it wasn't right. So now we're in communication. But yet, even though the restraining order is removed, that doesn't remove the felony no contact.
Okay.
Okay. So now I'm communicating with my attorney and I'm saying, hey, listen, you know, I'm communicating with him. And he's like, okay, well, tell him to call the office and he's going to do a subpoena. We're in communication. Okay. But this was not, are you seeing it? Yeah. I let him see his daughter. Okay. This is not known to this representation at the time that this was going on. I had no idea. And as far as being in fear, you're talking about a state of fear versus an incident where it's at a climax and you're in fear. You know, I didn't walk around in fear every day of my life with this man, because you got to think about it. I did at some point love him. I had a child, right? We lived together. But in those incidents where you're talking about domestic violence and at that climax where you're not certain you know, how far it's going to escalate, sure, that's another level of fear.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So as far as the going back, there was conversation because we were we had a child together. There, you know, I have filed for divorce paperwork. I did have that in place. But this is also something that my representation at that time was aware of and did not advise me at the time. Well, no, don't do this and let me go back to felony court and get this modified so you all could. That was never the case.
Okay. So to the notion of this trial, mm-hmm. why do you think the state of Florida and Angela Corey really wanted to prosecute you so vigorously? And why?
Well, you know, I can't speak for Angela Corey, but I will tell you this. I think that by the time it made it to the media aspect of it, then we remove all sorts of justice and legal due process, and now we're really getting into politics, right?
Mm.
And so at that point, it's really, you know, an act of defiance. She may have, you know, seen it as, whereas I, in my mind, am exercising my right to the constitutional law.
Sure.
Right?
Sure.
So for me, I don't even see it that way, and here I am with a 20-year sentence day for day, right? And as far as the thought process about, you know, why you vigorously, again, then that's me putting me in the mind of her. And the only thing I can say is I understand, you know, that district attorneys have a job to do, right? They are to uphold, you know, and make sure that they you know, exercise these their practices to make sure that they, you know, advocate for victims. And I understand that. And then there's also a line of overstepping and the abuse of your power, right? So, you know, I think it was very obvious to people that there was a lot of that going on because there was opportunities to resolve it, and that wasn't taking place. That didn't take place.
Why do you think you were convicted?
You know, being in a courtroom, I believe that, first of all, let me just set this scene. First of all, it's March Madness. It's like Thursday, Friday. It's like the worst time of a trial. You got like three men and three women. You know, the state only had two elements to prove, right? And that was pretty easy. So then the defense really had to say, was I justified, right? And I just think that it was just much easier for them to say, well, the state met the burden and not really consider me as a person,
right,
and the totality of what was going on. But the defense honestly did not necessarily, you know, perhaps maybe paint that picture. Now, from my experience through the trial, it was pretty obvious to the bailiffs. It was pretty obvious to the state. It was pretty obvious to the judge. But where, in terms of what the jury instructions were to them, then it was a pretty black and white thing. You know what I mean?
Yeah. So if it's your feeling that the judge understood that this is a travesty,
mm-hmm.
Well, now I'm answering my own question. You were sentenced to 20 years because the judge's hands were tied.
There you go. Right. And not only that, you have to think about it. These people are in the courtroom every day. The judge does this for a living. The state does it for a living. Now, to a juror who's a layman, we don't understand that what we're looking at in terms of when we get this 20 page and he's reading it, and, you know, and then instructions is saying if a witness is found to not be credible, you are to find the defendant not guilty. They don't even see that. Right? Because he's reading this thing and they're probably thinking about who's going to win and who's in the finals, you know, seriously. Yeah. Right? They are laymen. This is not what they do. You were picked, you were random, and you don't do it every day. And so these are the type of things that people don't get to see. And obviously, because it's like, what, 96% of the people are taking pleas?
Yeah.
And most people are not going to trial.
At what point did you become aware that 20 years was a very realistic end to this?
Well, I would say it was during the process of the pretrial process. I realized that was, because at first I just couldn't understand it. Even when I first obtained that attorney, I was like, well, why? Because as I understood 1020 life, it was for habitual violent offenders.
Right.
I did not fit into that. So why is that an issue for me? That is what and it didn't dawn on me until I was like, the state has a discretion. The state has the discretion. It's in the law if you read it. So they can either say, you know what, I'm going to waive the enhancement, or I'm not going to waive the enhancement. So we got to this position because it was a decision of the district attorney not to waive the enhancement.
So you're in court, and the jurors come back, and they say guilty.
Right.
And what is the feeling in that moment?
I wasn't shocked.
You were not shocked?
No. No.
Had you expected them to say that?
Unfortunately, because I could feel that. And that's something that I get into in my book. It was not a shock to me. It was just a shock to everybody else, but not to me.
And so was it the next day that the sentence was handed down?
No, it was a couple of, March, April, May. So it was about 2 months before the sentencing hearing actually took place. And so during this time, I knew, they're getting together a mitigation packet. But for me, I was like, not going to do 20 years. This is not the final end.
You were confident that you'd find a way out of this.
I wasn't confident, but I was confident in my prayers. I was confident in knowing that it was bigger than me. I was confident in knowing that it was my Goliath and I was David, and that it was bigger than me.
So the first night that you're like there and you've been convicted and you go to sleep and like, what is that like?
For me, I can speak for myself. So listen, it's like this, right? You've already been in there, because I'm sitting in there and you already get a feel for this, but I'm on the phone trying to encourage my family who is devastated. My mother didn't even leave the courtroom. She just sat there. And I just said, Ma, it wasn't his will. And so at some point, I did become angry. I was like, what in the heck do I do now? You know what I mean? Like, what now? And I didn't know. And so I was really, it took about a good week before it really registered. So it really wasn't the next day. It was a couple of days after that.
So you were in shock?
Yeah.
For like a week?
Just about.
And then you were like, oh my God.
No, then I was like, okay, God, so now what? Because I was angry with God.
You were angry with God?
Oh yeah, like, I'm going to be honest. I was like, wait a minute, now what? But, and then.
Did you question him?
I sure did.
Did it shake your faith?
No. I just knew that in spite of, I could question him, and I would like, I don't know what you want me to do now, but I'm going to still trust you. And so the next day, I remembered the magazine from Essence that had the organizers who got the Jamie Lynn Scott sisters out.
Okay.
And I wrote a letter. I think it was a 3-page letter. I called my family. I broke down the facts of the case, how I thought it was not right, and these different things. And I said, get it out to anybody, NAACP, ACLU, whoever. And, oh, yeah, and remember this lady right here? Look her up on the internet. And her name is Nancy Lockhart, and that's how my story got out.
And that's how people started to know. But what was life like for you inside?
You know, it was just, I had to become a different person in terms of survival, right? Because I had never been in jail or even really been in an environment where I'm confined. And then so you have so many different elements coming in and out of jail, different people, different individuals, different stories, different energies. And I really didn't know the best way to cope with that. So the best thing for me to do was just to be silent. You learn a lot from just not talking. And so I did. And so I decided at that point, I'm just going to not say much of anything, observe it, my environment, and I should be able to survive it. And that's just a coping mechanism. But then I got into the practice of just pushing everything down. Just, you cannot feel, you cannot cry in jail. I mean, you could, but I wasn't. You couldn't really feel. It was hard, but I had to. And it was just a way to survive.
Was it, did the other women know who you were in your case? Because there was a lot of noise around your case before the conviction.
No, you know why? Because they don't know me as Marissa Alexander. They know me as somebody else. I went by an initials in prison and in jail.
You told them?
I went by my initials, which is MJ, which is not MA, but my initials from my married name. And the intent was to, if I ever saw them again, and they said that, I'd be like, oh, I know them. That's where they know me from. And so MJ just stuck. So a lot of people, even to this day, like, they call me MJ. They don't call me Marissa. They didn't know. The only time they did know was when some type of newspaper or something would surface. That's how. They were like, oh, that looked like her. But other than that, and then at some point I was getting like 50 to 100 pieces of mail a day. And then people were kind of like, well, why? But that's it.
Was it violent?
No, not really. No. No, it was in a hostile environment. It's really in the women. I can speak for women in my experience. It's like this collective family, because we're all in the struggle, so to speak. So for women who are naturally nurturers, and a lot of them were mothers, right? It wasn't so much of violence. Did violence take place? Sure it did, right? But on a consistent, hostile type of day, it wasn't like that.
Was this medium security, maximum security?
I believe the facility that I was at is a maximum security, but it it's only two of them in Florida. So one was in Ocala, and that's where the one
It's interesting. It says a lot about nature and about women in general that you were in a maximum security prison, mm-hmm. and you didn't fear for your safety in there.
No, because, you know, by the time you get to that position, most people are, they have their sentence, they're just doing their time. A lot of them have been there a long time. The only time you have to kind of worry about that is people with short sentences or short timers. But a lot of the time, these women were very, very helpful in just trying to do their time. And they all had some sort of family, you know, within the family. It's a whole nother world within of itself. So why make your time hard by being, I mean, women in general, just we didn't necessarily do that.
Did prison change you?
I would say it transformed me.
How?
You know, it made me more, even more compassionate in understanding that even though what I went through, I was so fortunate and blessed to have people that loved and cared for me, that would fight for me, would stand in the gap for me, who made sure that I did not have any needs or, you know, wants. And then the privilege of having to go to school and get an education, and that so many people, you know, who looked like me did not have that opportunity. And so it just transformed me to really consider, when I get out, what did I want to do with that gift of being able to get out, right?
I mean, before we get to getting out, mm-hmm. as I was at MSNBC mm-hmm. when you were going through this, and I know I talked about it a lot, mm-hmm. Joy Reid talked about it a lot, Melissa Harris-Perry yes. talked a lot about it, right. Chris Hayes brought it up a lot of people talked about it. Did you, and so, and not just us, but Essence all over the right. place, on Twitter, everywhere, did you feel that energy, that people from outside saying, this is wrong, she should not be in prison?
Other than my family, I think what I knew that it was a conversation and it was being talked about was the amount of mail that I received. And it was from all over the world. It wasn't just national, it was international mail. And so I knew the only thing that could do that was some type of media outlet. I just didn't know what it looked like.
So I know you talked about your faith, mm-hmm. but it's got to be so hard to be. You did 5 years, right?
3 years inside an actual, you know, confinement, and then 2 years of house arrest at my home.
Okay. So mm-hmm. you did 3 years of confinement, mm-hmm. knowing deep in your soul, I should not be here. Mm-hmm. This is wrong. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's got to eat at you. I mean, does that not make it harder to do the time?
You know, that's when you lose hope. When you start taking, see, you have to have, when you're in dire straits like that, at least this was my position, that I had no room to place my energy into the anger, into the hurt. I felt it for sure. But I journaled. That was one of my outlets, right? But I had to keep myself positive, because the minute you start going down that dark road, you lose hope. And when you lose hope, then that's the end, right? So I had to remain hopeful. And in order for me to do that was to keep myself positive, light, energy, knowing, seeing myself on the outside. But I'm going to my kids' graduation. That's one of the things that kept me, knowing that I would get out and be able to go to their graduation. They graduate this year. I will be there. That's hope. So when you stand in the gap of the space of hope, and you do not, if you let go of hope, that's when you die. Like when you literally die to yourself, your faith, your belief in what the opportunity for the next something positive to happen, the miracle to happen. By staying positive, I left room for the miracle to take place.
I mean, you mentioned your two older children, mm-hmm. but you didn't yet mention your baby.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the core original just first years of your baby girl,
right?
You're I mean, right, the basket years, right. the you know, the bottle years, right. you missed mm-hmm. all that, mm-hmm. the first 3 years of her life, right. right? And was that eating at you?
Listen, it was, and I surrendered her, because other than that, I was gonna go crazy. I mean, that's hard. My baby was out there. I had no way of knowing how she was doing. It was intentionally done. She was kept from my family, right? And I had to surrender her to keep my sanity.
What do you mean surrender?
I mean, I had to pray and give her to God, meaning that whoever presence she was in, I had to pray for them too. Because at this point, I could not be well on the inside and live my controlling what I couldn't control on the outside.
Yeah.
Right? Wasn't easy, but that's what I decided to do in order to keep my sanity.
Because your ex-husband, mm-hmm. who he mm-hmm. had custody of her.
He went and got her from my mother, and he kept her, and I didn't see her until she was three.
The story, I mean, it's like Job, right? Or, I think about like Saint Rita, right? Like we're just a pile on everything, right? And I mean, it's amazing you say you didn't lose faith, but you did have the questions, and you continue to have questions throughout the 3 years of like, God, what are you doing?
Right. I mean, and I think that's it's okay to ask those questions, because then you get the answers you're looking for. You know, it's not that you won't question. I think you would be, you know, you would take, it would be almost like a settling if you didn't question. So then you could then say, because I was evolving again, I was transforming as a woman, as a person, just understanding different things, being able to, you know, take the weight of that and understanding what, you know, what next, what do you want me to learn from this? What am I to get from this? So that when I do come out, because I believe that I would, what would be my cause? What would that be? What would be my purpose?
If it was a movie,
mm-hmm.
there would
when
be...
When it's going to be a movie.
When it is a
there
movie,
you go.
there would be a woman in there in the prison who's wise, who helps you, who gives you a little bit more knowledge or nurturing than everyone. Was there a person or people who like were important to help me? Tell me.
Yes. So I have what we call, in when you do that type of time, is your prison mother, and I had a prison sister. So my prison mother is Lucy. My prison sister is Vaughn. And they were older women. And they were, Lucy was an example of just radical love. Okay. And then Vaughn was my sister. And she was just the truth. You know, she was a truth speaker. And she did it with love. And so for them to recognize, you know, and understand, because I didn't talk to a lot of different people. Right. But with them, they really held close to me and made sure that I was OK. And I still communicate with them and make sure that they're OK. So,
what do you mean by radical love?
I'm talking about the kind of love that when you see people and you're like, like they're kind of like, oh, God, I couldn't stand you. I don't care what you know, but they would love them in spite of. Right. Because what's going on with these people is they're hurt. They have been traumatized their whole life, but for them, they can see past the things that they do, which is the what, and understand the why and love them anyway. And they represented that. They showed me those things. And that's why I wanted to model that.
So why were you let out early?
In terms of my appeal?
Yeah. You did the 3 years mm-hmm. and then the 2 years in the house. But, I mean, the state intended for you to sit in there for 20-some years.
Right.
So, what was it that allowed you to get out earlier than 20 years?
Well, I mean, I was fortunate enough that there was organizers and people. You know, people petitioning, rallying, signing, you know,
media.
All media attention. And somebody saying, wait a minute, this thing down in, you know, Orlando, but wait a minute, what's going on with, you know, this lady up here in Jacksonville, and saying, wait a minute, something about this isn't right. You can kill somebody and go away scot-free, but you can shoot a drywall and get 20 years. And this conversation. And then there's organizers, and there's Free Marissa Now with Elisa Byaria and Samaya Coleman, and the groups from Love and Protect out of Chicago, Miriam Combo, and those with Survived and Punished. Again, people like you doing what they do. And then you have my attorneys, who are absolutely phenomenal attorneys, who care about me like I'm their daughter. And like, we're doing what's best for her. We don't care about what it looks like in becoming a hero. We need to make calculated decisions to make sure she gets home. And so in the work that they did with their firms, they were able to find the jury instructions, that was an issue. And even if it was a technicality, it worked. And so my case was overturned.
So when you are overturned and you're like, oh, my God, I'm going to go home. What is the feeling there?
The feeling is like a pause. It's like, I want to get happy, but I know there's a next step of this. Because just because it wasn't like it got overturned and, you know, I was, you know, like, peace out, I'm out of the jail. It was not like that. This then started a whole nother process of trauma, because now I'm dealing with the system in a very intense way, because somebody was like, you got proven wrong. Your case got overturned. Now I'm an example. Now there's a case law. There's a precedent. So guess what? That's open to other people to use. It's a whole nother level of intensity, because now this particular time we're going back to trial, but in a way different way than we did the first time. So I was grateful. I was happy, but I knew I was caught. I was hesitant, because I was like, what is this next phase going to look like for me? And I wasn't sure.
The first moment that you were able to hold your baby again. What was that like?
Oh, man. So, you know, prior to, I was able to, okay, well, so when she first came into to the jail to see me, from prison, that was the first time I seen her until, you know, while she was a baby and she was three. And she ran up to me and I was shocked, because obviously she, how would she just run up to me like that? Because we hadn't had a connection. And it was just the pure grace of God that my best friend was able to get her for him while he was driving. And she would keep pictures of my baby and say, this is your mommy. What's her name? It's Marissa. This is mommy. We're going to say a prayer for her at night. We're going to say a prayer for her in the morning. So she recognized mommy with that picture. So when she seen me, that was her reaction. She said, go up and get your mama. And she ran up to me and jumped up to me.
Wow. And then what was the feeling for you?
The best thing ever, because I have pages and pages of journals of me being like, oh my God, what is the bond going to be like? What, I don't know if she's going to know me, if she's going to recognize me, all of these things. And then to look at her, my this little person that I'm finally able to hold, and she, you know, that I prayed about for years, was an indescribable feeling. I really can't describe it.
I keep coming back to, how did you survive this nightmare? And I know you talk about faith, but beyond that specific log helping you, how did you survive? What in you, in your makeup, in your character, allowed you to survive this nightmare?
You know, what keeps being said over and over is some form of resilience, right? Giving up was not an option. That was just it. Giving up was not an option. Now, what I had to do to get through it, you know, it may it be a tattoo here or there, whatever, but giving up was not an option.
Why did God put you through this? Now that you can look back.
I believe there was purpose in this long before I was even here sitting here with you, right? So it's not like he's sitting up there like, oh, shoot, she done fired a gun. I got to figure out my next step for her life. He already knows, right?
Sure.
So being that he made me who I am, he knew that, okay, you know, you think about like all these years when you're in school and you have your own mind and they're telling you you're defiant and you're like, no, I'm not. And then you get your life together and you're a leader and you're learning all these things. And all of those things throughout my life that I experienced and was able to accomplish and learn really have been helpful in this next phase of understanding now what I am to do with it. So it's like knowing your assignment.
What have you done since you got out to help repair your spirit and your soul?
You know, really a lot of self-care and self-reflection. I work out. That's a part of my self-care. I feel what I feel, be honest with myself, because I think that's human. I think you should be human, and I think you should be allowed to be human. I did not take a vacation until, I think, last year for the first time. Actually go on a family vacation, and that was very healing for me. We just went down to Orlando and spent a whole week there at one of the resorts. And just, you know, the kids were so happy for that all of my kids were together, you know. So those things were healing. I have really, really good few and close friends that are close to me, and a great family support that also provides some level of healing, because then I was able to come out and talk to family members. And because when you're in time, during time, they're doing it with you.
Oh, yeah.
Right. And so just being able to see those things. And so for me to heal, and I'm still healing, I have not arrived at this point of, oh, healing's done, I'm good. It's of nothing course. Like that. It yeah. is an evolution. It is continual process. So I just, you know, I have a little toolbox of that, and I just have to keep replacing the tools as the ones that I had before to help with my healing are no longer working like they may have. I may have to replace that. So right now, you know, it's right now I work out, I read, I have me time. You know, those type of things.
I know a lot of people who've been locked away for a while talk mm-hmm. about feeling institutionalized, and mm-hmm. it remains on them for years after they get out. Do you feel that?
No. No, I think when I first got home, I felt some habits, you know what I mean, that were, was like, okay, wait a minute, that's different, you know what I mean? But in terms of an institutionalized mind or behavior, I just, the truth be told, I never accepted that I was a criminal or an inmate. I never allowed for that to be snatched away from me. I never allowed for myself to be dehumanized, that I was not Marissa Alexander, instead J46944. You understand what I mean? So it was a intentional, purposeful defiance to say that is not who you said that I am. And so it allowed for me to remain as close intact to who I was and who I was becoming as possible.
I mean, who you are in life mm-hmm. has transformed, right? You've right. become this national figure, a symbol, mm-hmm. and a person for whom something extraordinary happened to you, mm-hmm. right? You didn't do it, right? It was thrust upon you, mm-hmm. and now you have to go forward dealing with it. I just wonder, what do you see for the rest of your life, or at least for the next few years, mm-hmm. from this thing that was thrust upon you that you have to now deal with?
Well, you know, there's this piece, there's accountability in it, right? And then helping people understand in a sense that the accountability that doesn't take away that I'm, you know, that it was a victimization that was done, but just as a movement of understanding from a domestic violence and what that looks like from a prevention standpoint is really the way I want to go. Because I think there is a lot of services that are offered around awareness and things that happen after the fact. But if you really talk to, you know, some people, they really don't even know what domestic violence looks like outside of what some extreme cases on TV talks does. So really, let's have real conversations about where in it is the accountability. Not to say that a person deserves it, whether they chose to stay in a relationship or not, because I want to be really clear, that's not what I'm saying. But really, as an individual, when things started to happen, what was going on with me that allowed for warning signs to be ignored? And like, really have those conversations, because we're seeing this even with young girls in the K-12, right? Mm-hmm. And then really opening that up and saying, well, what does that look like? And bringing boys and men into those conversations as well, because we need to have that dialogue, right? Mm-hmm. And then being very intentional about moving forward so that we're not excluding a group of people that we actually have to be intimate partners with in order for the healing and the conversations to happen, and say, you know, in my place, I didn't know what it looked like before. I value those great times over those times where my gut was saying, Marissa, this ain't right. And then choosing to stay in it. Right. And domestic violence relationships are very complex, but helping navigate that for people so that they can understand what happens and triggers and things that could happen, and understanding what a healthy relationship is, what a functioning relationship is, a dysfunctional relationship is, understanding what control looks like when it's subtle and when it's maybe overt. Right. But start really doing that preventative work so that we can kind of understand how we got there, or better yet, before it grows legs and then you're at the mercy of death or the criminal system. So
one day you will have to explain this mm-hmm. to your daughter.
Right.
Do you think about what you'll say, what you'll leave out?
No, you know, I really haven't. And let me tell you why, because first of all, I have to be honest with myself. First of all, this is the 21st century. And she will more than likely find out about it before I know that she knows about it.
Mm.
Right? And then have to have a conversation with me. Maybe even a conversation with her father. I'm very intentional in making sure that I'm committed to her well-being, and that the trauma that we both experience, that she doesn't, it's not, she's not impacted by it. how well I'm doing it. I'm hoping I am doing well, because co-parenting the person, you know, co-parenting with the person that you actually had the issue with is a whole nother thing, right? But in the event when she does, if she discovers it beforehand and then she comes to me, or better yet, she'll have a contextual background of the living environment enough to be able to say, well, Mom, I want to ask you this, and allowing her to, if it was from media or from something she heard, just giving her the space to be able to do that and feel what she feels. And it's coming. I just don't know what it's going to look like. Right.
You are co-parenting with her father?
Yes.
So you are still interacting with him?
Well, we interact through a tool. It's called Talking Parents. So we message through that. But you have to consider, there's other people out there who don't look like Marissa Alexander per se in terms of how, you know, intense my situation got, that still have to parent with the person that is the father or mother of that child.
Absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely.
So this is not uncommon, right?
No, yes, of course.
And so the idea is to do it in the best way that allows for us to do the very best in rendering our child and co-parenting. So for us, what it looks like is, and you know, that was in a court order. We could talk if we so choose to, but I think the best thing for our situation is to do it through that tool, and other people can use the tool if that so be the case. And it works. We communicate through that tool. The way that it's designed in our parenting plan is that it's, you know, the school is a drop off and pick up point. It's very, very clear about how we do that.
So you're not seeing him.
Right. Right.
Dropping her off. You're picking her up, and we don't have to be in the same room.
Right.
And
there's no interaction that needs to take place with that in place. But just say, for instance, right, if there's a school play and he wants to go and I want to go, we would be in the same space. The commitment is to, it ain't about us. It's about Brianna in the play.
And you are both, and really speaking for you, mm-hmm. Able to put the whatever feel crazy feelings aside, mm-hmm. and just focus on Brianna having a nice day.
I can tell you that I make that choice. I really can't control what he does.
Of course.
Right?
Of course.
But in the event that he can't, I still can control what I would do. And my position would be to make sure that whatever action that took place, that it would be about her and not about me but about anything that had gone on with him.
What societal changes do you think need to be made?
Ooh.
Following you slipping through the mm-hmm. cracks, and you know, Stand Your Ground was not available to mm-hmm. you, the mandatory minimums, you know, that was a problem. I mean, there were so many legal mm-hmm. problems with the situation. What changes do you want to see made?
You know, I think honestly, and just addressing the conversation of restorative justice and what it looks like to punish trauma, right? Because I've seen it in my situation, but I've also seen it with mental health. I've seen it with people who are on drugs and things like that. What really needs to happen is a conversation and a shift, as opposed to just straight, you know, punishment and penalizing people, but move the conversation towards really restorative practices, so that we don't continue to feed the cycle.
So where is your faith now that you've been through, you know, the belly of the beast and come out of it?
Where's my faith now? Oh, it's 10 times even higher. Like, if it could go any higher, I'd be floating. My head would be too big to go in this room. I mean, seriously. You know, because there's a bit of, like, survivor's remorse sometimes, but you have to consider the impact of being able to be in the conversation with you so that other people can hear it and hopefully are inspired and have another conversation, or can, you know what I mean? To kind of be a beacon, you know, not that that's what I chose to do, but that's what I'm doing now. So I'm so grateful for the opportunities. And so my faith is forever, you know, being reinforced. You know, it's not that I'm always faithful every day, right? But I'm reinforced with the opportunity that, you know what? I am one in a million that was able to get out, so I'm able to give in and support.
Indeed. All right. Thank mm-hmm. you so much. I know y'all got to go. I know you got to go home. I appreciate you so much.
Oh, thank you.
So much.
After all that, I had to give her a hug. What an emotional story. Marissa is such an inspiration. I'm not a spiritual person, but I love how faith helped pull her through her ordeal. Thanks to Marissa for her time, and thanks to you for listening. I'm on Twitter at Torre and on Instagram at Torre Show. Please stop by and say hi. And if you like the show, subscribe, rate, and review. It really does help. And talk about it on your socials. Let people know what's really good. Torre Show is written by me, Torre, and produced by Chris Colbert and Chris Basil, with help from Shelby Royston, William Jolly, Candid Nicole, Cadence 13 Studios, and our photographer, Chuck Marcus. We're here to give you fuel to power your dreams, because you can use your dreams like a rocket ship to blast you into a life you never imagined. You can make your dreams a reality. And I hope this show can be a help. We'll be back next Wednesday with more knowledge from amazing folks, because the man can't shut us down.